Support for Bright Public is provided by FM Rotary Foundation's 5th Annual Rotary Ride, September 9th at Lindenwood Park, Fargo. Proceeds go to Gigi's Playhouse and Charism. Registration information is available at fmrotaryride.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and our show is called Main Street because our microphones create a virtual Main Street all across North Dakota and our neighboring states. This time of day, and of course, we have those real ones that we love to cross and greet our friends and neighbors and talk about what's on our minds, maybe chew the fat a bit about some serious, deep discussion that, you know, we're anxious to have. And today we're going to have a deep discussion with a professor of theology at Concordia College. Dr. Hilda Koester is also the author of Planetary Solidarity, Global Women's Voices on Christian Doctrine and Climate Justice, a long title for a book that comes out today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
How would you describe the reason for writing this book?
Well, 2 years ago, Pope Francis came out with an encyclical called Laudato Si, beautiful, beautiful letter to the faithful on the environment and on climate change. Unfortunately, the letter did not really talk about women and how women are affected by climate change. So we felt a book was needed on that very topic.
And what are the issues that connect climate change and women around
the
world?
We see that women, and this is also studied by, for instance, the United Nations, are disproportionately affected by climate change and the effects of climate change around the world, but especially in poor countries. And what you see is that women there often lose their livelihood due to rising sea waters, drought. And that basically causes upheaval not only for themselves, but also for their children.
So how did you assemble the diverse group of women who contributed to the book you co-edited with Grace Ji-Sun Kim?
Well, I had this idea for the book, and then I talked to Grace Ji-Sun Kim, who is a Korean-American theologian, and who also works on issues of climate change and climate justice, especially through the World Council of Churches. So she seems to be the appropriate person to work with on this book. And we just started to spread the word and gather women from around the globe to work with us on this book. And Doug, we have some wonderful women in this book. Sally McFaig, one of the leaders of ecofeminist theology. Ifoni Ribeira from Brazil, a wonderful grassroots theologian and also a leader in ecofeminist theology, and many, many more women.
Well, since Earth Day was being discussed a long time ago, environmental activism has generated controversy. And actually, there are places in the world where being an environmental activist is downright dangerous, aren't there?
Yeah, and we have an article in the book. It's very moving by a woman from the Philippines who writes about the risks that women activists who protest mining in the Philippines are experiencing. Their lives are really at danger. Women have been murdered for their activism on behalf of environmental justice.
So the goal of the book is to get people to talk about this connection and maybe help?
And also to see how these issues are different around the globe. Our issues here in Western North Dakota are different than the issues that people face in the Philippines. But it's a matter of creating a deep sense of solidarity with people in places elsewhere.
How is the religious community responding to the call for environmental activism? I mean, there are lots of different kinds of churches and belief systems.
That is true. But I think that if you look at mainstream Christianity, and the Pope is a great example of that, of course, churches have responded very strongly and have taken not necessarily a lead, but have become leaders when it comes to raising awareness about climate change and especially about how poor people are affected by it. My own denomination, the Lutheran Church, has been a leader in this as well, and so has Concordia College.
Are there some religious practices that kind of combine theology with ideology and maybe muddy the waters here?
Absolutely. There are many people who feel, and especially maybe people who identify with more politics on the right, that have a hard time connecting faith and environmental issues. But Doug, when you start thinking about it, it makes a lot of sense that Christians, Muslims, Jews are concerned about this. Think, for instance, about the fact that all these religions affirm God as the creator. Well, if you think about the world as created by God, then the world is a gift, and a gift you need to respect. So there are lots of religious beliefs that naturally, in my view, lead us to respect for the earth.
So what does a theologian make of the polarized political attitudes we've been talking about human activities that contribute to global warming, climate change?
Yeah, these issues, especially within the community, in faith communities, are challenges. And I think we are challenged to think hard and deep about these issues, to go back to the scripture, back to our faith traditions, and really ask ourselves, what is it that we are called to do in this particular moment?
What do you think is the proper way to relate science to religion and vice versa?
That is a very deep and in many ways difficult question. There is a lot of misunderstanding that Christian faith, especially, for instance, belief in evolution or scientific knowledge about climate change, are at odds with one another. And that's a misunderstanding because these two different discourses tell different stories. Science does something different than religion. Science is about how questions, how did things come to be? Religion asks why questions, questions about meaning, and questions about how we are to live.
But there are religions that take a very narrow view, perhaps of, let's take a book like the Bible, and says, the Bible says this. I don't care what science says. The Bible says this, because they interpret it their way.
Religions are many things. Religions are plural. So within Christianity, for instance, there are very different ways of reading the Bible. There are very different ways of thinking about what our relationship to the natural world ought to be. And their conversation is so incredibly important. And that's why we did this book in many ways, to teach people of how we can think about things like salvation or God and creation in ways that are very biblical and very traditional, but lead us in the direction of earth care.
Let's change the subject a bit to your chapter in the book, which is provocatively titled Trafficked Lands, Sexual Violence, Oil, and Structural Evil in the Dakotas. Why did you choose that subject?
Well, we asked the writers for the book to really write about things that are going on in their own context, their own geographical and cultural context. And here in Western North Dakota, of course, we are thinking about the extraction industry and about oil and what it's doing to the water, what it's doing to the soil, what it's doing to our communities. And that's what I wanted to write about.
But this is a community that is somewhat distant from you. You're not a member of the Standing Rock Reservation, for example, or were you on the front lines of the Dakota Access Pipeline? Why that particular issue?
Well, I'm doing my theology here. I've been here for 15 years, so I have made this my home. And I think that what we can learn from the issues that are going on here with the extraction industry do apply elsewhere as well.
So we need to apply some moral and ethical guidelines, I guess, to help us work through this issue. We have a fossil fuel industry that moves the world right now.
Absolutely.
And yet that industry is controversial because of the climate change issue. And what are we going to do? I mean, are we expecting the captains of industry to suddenly say, I'm sorry, board of directors, but this is not right?
I'm very glad you're asking this question. This is really a big challenge because there is short-term economic gain that we can get from the extraction industry on all kinds of levels of society. And there is still more oil in the ground. And the challenge here is that because of the future and because of the way the climate, when it's changing the way and as rapidly as it is changing right now, is endangering that future, the challenge is that we need to leave it in the ground and we need to forego short-term gains. That's very hard, but that's our challenge. And I think religion can help us with that.
Well, we have a current event that is a hurricane named Harvey that crashed into Texas, and that part of the United States is energy concentrated. I mean, it's where the oil is pumped, it's where the oil is piped, it's where it's refined, it's where it's shipped. Isn't there a bit of irony that a storm that some people are looking at as a bellwether of climate change is hitting that part of the world so hard?
It's a moment in which we need to pause as a nation, and we really need to start thinking very hard about the kind of risks that we are taking. It's also clear that climate change is making the hurricanes that we are experiencing more severe. Climate change is heating up the atmosphere, it's heating up the oceans, and that means that storms are more severe, rainfall is more severe. And we have seen that played out in Houston. And yes, there is a lot of irony. But it's tragic if we don't start to think about the message that we're getting here.
Hilda Koester is the author of Planetary Solidarity, Global Women's Voices on Christian Doctrine and Climate Justice. And let's get back to women here. Are you asking women to be more active?
Well, I think that women around the globe are already very active. And what we wanted to do with this book is to lift up their voices. The voices of women activists in the Philippines, the voices of women activists in Zambia or in South Africa. We wanted to give the message that we need to listen to these women who are experiencing the consequences of climate change in a very immediate way already. And we wanted to invite them to tell us what the problems are that they are experiencing.
Now, the book you've written, this Planetary Solidarity, is a thick book with lots of deep ideas and experiences that are shared in it. But in a sense, isn't that book likely to be picked up and read by people who pretty much accept the thesis of the book to start with?
I think that is probably true. And I hope that other people will pick the book up as well. But it is a book that wants to educate people who are interested in climate justice, especially on the issues of gender justice, but also on theology, Doug. Because one of the problems with the encyclical is that the theology in the encyclical is very traditional, very patriarchal. So very focused on the theology of men. And we wanted to change that. We wanted to bring the voices of women also into the way we do theology, the way we talk about God, the way we talk about Jesus, the way we talk about divine love, the way we talk about creation, and the spirit, how the spirit moves us. Those are the topics of the book as well.
Isn't the challenge, though, to get the idea, that kind of nuanced thinking, out in front of a lot more people?
But think of all the ministers that can read this book and can start preaching from it.
It seems that your ideal world would be filled with leaders whose first instincts would be to adhere to moral and ethical practices. Now, I've asked this question, but why don't we have that world?
We've never had that world. I think that it's part of the way of a figure like Jesus, but also a Gandhi and all these leaders, that they show us that we need to kind of be courageous, walk the walk, live the life of love and compassion and work towards justice, even though that is not the way the world works. That's our challenge. And I think for me, very much as a Christian, that is what I take from the figure of Jesus.
Thank you. Hilda Koester is the author of Planetary Solidarity, Global Women's Voices on Christian Doctrine and Climate Justice. More Main Street in a moment.
The devastation from Hurricane Harvey is still being added up. After nearly a week of record rainfall, people who lived in the storm's path are just starting to grasp the damage to their homes, their businesses, and their communities. More on the aftermath of Harvey and all the week's news, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Well, whether or not Hurricane Harvey is a bellwether of climate change, it is wreaking havoc on the oil industry. It's shuttered 22% of the nation's refining capacity as refineries along the Gulf Coast halt operations due to damage and flooding. Inside Energy's Amy Sisk looks at what this means for oil produced far from the path of the hurricane and how it's affecting gasoline prices.
Oil industry groups and state officials in North Dakota, the country's second biggest oil producer, say the hurricane isn't yet having a measurable impact. Instead, the impact is happening when oil leaves the state. Much of North Dakota's oil travels to the Midwest on pipelines. The same goes for oil out of Colorado and Wyoming. There, it's either turned into products like gasoline, or it's sent down to refineries in Texas or Louisiana. But with those Gulf refineries shut down,
you'll see increased refinery demand in the Midwest as it makes up for the loss of gasoline supply in the U.S. Gulf Coast here in the short term.
Nicole Leonard is with Platts Analytics Oil and Gas Consulting. She says it's also possible Western states could see more oil train traffic if companies choose to ship oil to West Coast refiners instead of to the Gulf.
The upside to Bakken producers, as well as Colorado and Wyoming producers, is that they still have access to rail infrastructure.
This would temporarily reverse a trend in these states in recent years. Transporting oil by rail had fallen way off as companies built new pipelines to get oil to market. A lot depends on how much damage refineries sustained in the storm, whether pipelines in the region stay shut down, and how quickly ports in the Gulf can open back up to export crude stored in the region.
Without the ability to do so, we have inventories growing here, and the value of our crude is lower because it's stuck.
If the price of crude continues to drop due to these disruptions, Leonard says it would affect producers in oil-rich states. Oil is currently worth $47 per barrel. If it drops below $40, producers won't be able to make a profit, and drilling new wells would likely taper off. While all this plays out, drivers are noticing a spike in gasoline prices. Gene LeDucer is with AAA in North Dakota.
There's plenty of gasoline out there in storage and ready to serve the needs. It's just that it's virtually impossible at this time to get that gasoline that's available to the markets where it's needed because of, you know, flooded roads and pipelines that are down and power outages and those types of issues.
As a result, the average gasoline price in the nation is the highest it's been all year at $2.45 per gallon. LeDucer says the jump in price is highest in eastern and southern states that get gasoline from the Gulf, where refineries and pipelines are shut down. Western states get their gasoline from other parts of the country, but they're still feeling an impact. In North Dakota, LeDucer says a gallon of gasoline has jumped 10 to 15 cents since Tuesday. And he thinks it may rise another 10 cents in the coming days, just in time for Labor Day weekend, when a lot of people are traveling.
Unfortunately, with the price spikes we're seeing, it could encourage some people to stay home. You know, once you start seeing your gasoline go up, you know, 10, 15, 20 cents or more, it might start to impact on your household budgets a little bit.
But he says the impact won't last too much longer. He expects prices to return to normal by mid-September. By then, analysts say some of the Gulf refineries should be back online and ports opened up, helping provide certainty to an industry where so much can be rattled by a force of nature. For Inside Energy, I'm Amy Sisk.
Inside Energy is a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. Coming up next on Main Street, Jamestown's Bruce Berg.
On the next Radio Lab,
my grandparents were mind readers.
on the radio.
After I've died, people will still say, how did they do that?
Meet the Piddingtons on the next Radiolab.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. Bruce Berg lives in Jamestown, where he taught English for many years before retiring to keep busy doing other things he loves. He writes and voices commentaries for Main Street about the many things he's interested in. And today, his topic is the family split.
In my lifetime, I've seen differences of political opinion in families, but never quite like today. The dry, dusty, sometimes dirty world of the political has taken on hues I'd not seen before. At one time, our political response could borrow from Melissa Manchester's song, Midnight Blue. Whatever it is can wait till tomorrow. Haven't we both got something else to do? And our response to what was going on could wait until tomorrow because our governmental machine ran the same no matter who was in charge. Turn the key in the back of the robotic legislator, and he, she said the same old, same old. It was party overall, with the implication that there was public service to the country. Nothing risky was said because election day was never that far away. Was this the well-oiled machine? Was it deemed too dull for the electric? Maybe we thought we didn't have to check the oil. It had been such a smooth ride, and now there were big bumps on the road and a machine that made noise we'd never heard before. Families were split. Some thought the 250-year-old model was just fine, and some thought the machine needed a drastic overhaul. But the awareness that good mechanics were needed seemed lost at times. There were some who were put behind the steering wheel who didn't know how to drive, and many in the crowd didn't know the difference between those who knew the car and those who pretended to know the car. The race got loud. The officials threw up checkered flags. Some of the drivers kept their eyes on the rear-view windows, and some tried to look ahead. Family night at the races took on another tone. Cars were jumping the track, people got hurt, one lost the privilege of being indifferent. It was as risky to be watching as it was to be on the track, although many of the drivers just went around the track, waiting until the next time when they could go around and around the track again. They didn't win anything, they didn't lose anything, they just put on their suits and went round and round. The political race is louder than it used to be. Flags go up at nearly every turn. The track runs from right to left, and the drivers don't seem to like each other. The people in the stands have reached an intolerance for each other also. And the public address announces that a pileup could be imminent. And if you listen carefully, you can still hear, whatever it is, we can wait till tomorrow. Haven't we all got something else to do? Not so true anymore. This is Bruce Berg, Jamestown.
Coming up on Main Street, a Plains Folk essay from Tom Ezern, an interview by our Mike Olson with Bonnie Raitt, and a new movie review from Matt Olean. This week it's Wind River. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Calling it a win for national security and for taxpayers, Congressman Kevin Cramer says Dickinson-based Fisher Sand and Gravel has been awarded a federal contract to develop a prototype for President Trump's wall along the border with Mexico. In a statement from his office, Cramer says Fisher Industries was one of four firms selected by U.S. Customs and Border Protection.
I saw their presentation that they prepared for the Department of Homeland Security, and I was impressed. I was impressed with the design and frankly quite confident they'd make it to the top of the list.
Customs and Border Patrol are looking at two different signs, designs. One would have the border wall constructed with concrete. The second request calls for a design other than concrete. Construction of the prototypes is expected to take place this fall. Grand Forks police say welfare checks on individuals contemplating suicide have become fairly common. Grand Forks Police Department Derek Zimmel says many of those calls are the result of social media postings that alarm friends or relatives. North Dakota's suicide rate continues to be above the national average and is the second leading cause of death among the state's youth. According to the 2015 Youth Risk Survey, over 20% of high school female students and 12% of male students seriously considered suicide during the previous 12 months. Allison Traynor is the North Dakota Health Department's Suicide Prevention Director.
Ask them directly if they're thinking about suicide. I know it's an uncomfortable question to ask. What I recommend is that if you get an affirmative, either take that individual to the emergency room. If you can, then you certainly can call law enforcement to do a well check and to do transport for you.
Traynor says proven prevention programs do exist and more people are seeking treatments and getting better.
Like the nation, we have been seeing some peaks and valleys, but overall the trajectory has been sort of slowly inching up.
There were 134 reported suicides in North Dakota in 2016. And a recent study by North Dakota State University shows the five tribal colleges in North Dakota contribute $192 million to the state's economy. United Tribes Technical College President Russ McDonald says the study was part of a larger review called for by the state university system. McDonald says for United Tribes, that number shows a nearly $60 million economic impact for the Bismarck-Mandan area. He says it's a number worth talking about.
I think it's important for the Bismarck-Mandan communities to recognize our contribution to the area and the fact that we employ 220 full-time positions here that really help out to provide some resources here because all of our employees live here, work here, spend their money here.
McDonald says UTTC's contribution is increasing. He says a previous study showed the college with a $32 million impact. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. One of our regular Friday features will be absent today because our news director, Dave Thompson, has the day off. Enjoy, Dave. Tom Ezern is a regular, too. He's a distinguished professor of history at NDSU and a prolific writer. Among other things, he writes and voices the Plainsfolk essays for us, and today's essay is titled Anthem of the Plains.
The great historian of country music in America has to be Bill Malone, who published the pioneering work in the field, Country Music USA, in 1968. I just finished reading his new book of collected essays, Sing Me Back Home, Southern Roots and Country Music. One of Bill's key interpretive points about country music is that we may have overestimated the importance of Southern mountain music in shaping the field. He finds, for instance, that many of the early country hits originated from Tin Pan Alley as popular music and were adopted into the country canon. Bill devotes a whole chapter to the composing career of William S. Hayes, the Bard of Kentucky, a writer of popular tunes, including the old standard, Little Old Log Cabin in the Lane. Now, this is what got me interested in the story of William Hayes. His Little Old Log Cabin in the Lane, published in 1871, traveled west and was adapted to life on the plains. Indeed, as the historian Malone says, Little Old Log Cabin in the Lane may be one of the most parodied songs in history. Charles W. Fry, the first bandmaster of the Salvation Army, lifted the tune and used it for his hymn, The Lily of the Valley. I have found a friend in Jesus, he's everything to me. He's the fairest of 10,000 to my soul. Well, then the cowboy singer, Jack Thorpe, converted Hayes' song into a tragic cowboy ballad, Little Joe the Wrangler. Now it's Little Joe the Wrangler, he'll wrangle nevermore. His days with the remudo, they are done. 'Twas a year ago, last April, he rode into our camp. Just a little Texas stray and all alone. In Australia, they sing another song, The Freehold on the Plain, spun off from the Hayes composition. The parody of Hayes' song that spread throughout the Great Plains of North America, however, was Little Old Sod Shanty on the Claim. More than 20 years ago, I investigated the assertion that the author of this Anthem of the Plains was one Everett Calvin Motts of Selden, Kansas. The basis of the claim of authorship was that descendants had a cabinet card photograph of old Everett depicting him in front of his sod house, and on the back were printed the stanzas to Little Old Sod Shanty on the Claim. This was not exactly definitive evidence. I give no more credence to the local claim that Henry A. Ball of Walsh County, North Dakota, wrote Little Old Sod Shanty in the early 1880s. Problem is, there are versions dating from years earlier in other parts of the plains. Now, well into the 21st century, I return to the investigation of the origin of this Great Plains folk song, with new information systems at my disposal. The saga of the song, as I now have reconstructed it, ranges north and south over the states of the Great Plains before settling into a North Dakota denouement. Over the next few weeks, I'll share some findings about that little old sod shanty on the claim, where the hinges are of leather, the windows have no glass, and I hear the hungry coyote as he sneaks up through the grass.
That's Tom Ezern, who occasionally bursts into song, a nice prelude to a voice coming up on Main Street, singer-songwriter Bonnie Raitt.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by FM Rotary Foundation's 5th Annual Rotary Ride, September 9th at Lindenwood Park, Fargo. Proceeds go to Gigi's Playhouse and Charism. Registration information is available at fmrotaryride.com.
And by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, serving 2.8 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. Singer-songwriter Bonnie Raitt will perform at Moorhead's Bluestem Amphitheater tonight with the Indigo Girls. On Tuesday, she'll be in Bismarck with Anders Osborne. Raitt is one of the most acclaimed musicians of her generation. She's been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the Blues Hall of Fame. She's been nominated 26 times for Grammy Awards, and she won 10 of them. She's also well known for helping to fundraise for charities that deal with the environment and wildlife and social justice and other issues. Prairie Public music host Mike Olson got her on the phone, and we pick up their conversation as she reminisces about going off to college.
Well, as you said about Newport, I always wished I could go to Greenwich Village and the Newport Folk Festival up in Rhode Island, and I was just too young. You know, I was a member of Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and asking them what I could do from Los Angeles, but I was up in my bedroom with no car at 13, so there was no, I just couldn't get old enough, fast enough, you know. So I was so happy to finally, as most of us are, leave the nest and get to college. And the Boston scene was so lively for music, and you know, there was an incredible anti-war movement going on in the beginning of feminism, and I think there's over 300 colleges in the Boston area, and we were all active and excited, and it was thrilling to be 18, and I chose to go to school, that school of the ones I was accepted, because I really wanted to be in Cambridge because of its history of folk music and activism.
That period was so influential and had been for so many years. There's a book that Eric Von Schmidt and Jim Rooney wrote that I've read for years called Baby, Let Me Follow You Down. That's kind of the history of that scene. And which
absolutely. It's one of my favorite books as well. I have it right 15 feet from me right now.
Cool. Bonnie, and you've made a great contribution to it.
Thank you.
Recently reread it. And yeah, it's something that, you know, I've studied it because what's amazing to me is how much that scene and the people involved in it have influenced my life as well as so many others across the country and across the world because of the music and the change and so much that is associated with that, all the social activism and that's the scene you became a part of. And you were playing the blues. Were you playing out at that point when you got there?
I was just playing in my room. I mean, some of the kids down the hall said, hey, you know, you're pretty good. And, you know, I didn't start thinking about playing professionally. And really, it was just as a kind of turning my hobby into making some little bit extra money. I had been working, cleaning apartments, riding around on my bike my freshman year. And then I took a semester off because I started dating someone that managed Mississippi Fred McDowell and had been one of the three guys that rediscovered Son House, the father of Delta Blues. And he managed Big Boy Arthur Crudup and Buddy Guy and Junior Wells, and he lived right there in Cambridge, and we became friends, and eventually he was my booking agent for 15 years in my office. I took a semester off, and my folks said, if you drop out of school, you have to support yourself. So I had a job for a few months at the American Friends Service Committee as a transcriptionist several days a week, and I just was not into the daytime dress-up job. So I went to a club, and there was a woman playing who really wasn't that much better than what I thought I was. I said to Dick, do you think I could audition for this guy and get a gig opening for some of the bands here locally? And he said, sure, and I made the cut. And the next thing I know, I came back a couple of times, and then Dick got me a couple other gigs. And then I went back to college in Cambridge and started to work at the coffee house scene in Worcester, Massachusetts, about an hour away, and working on the weekends. And next thing I know, it was just... one gig into another, opening for my heroes like John Hammond and Cat Stevens and James Taylor. And then I got offered a record deal at what would have been my junior year. And I said, okay, if you give me complete artistic control and never tell me what to do, how to dress, what to play, who to work with, I'll do it. And Warner Brothers went for it. I can't even believe it, because it's not like I was Prince and writing my own material.
Yes, it is. It's amazing. And you wanted to be on Warner Brothers because that was the label that Randy Newman and Ry Cooder were on?
Absolutely. You've done your homework.
For me, I got on to Ry. Well, actually, the record that was really started to open doors for me was Taj Mahal's Recycling Blues and the other related stuff, and that picture of Taj with Mississippi John Hurt. And that's when
absolutely. Isn't that the greatest? That is so great. I mean, and to say that he's another person that was so influential, and then Little Feet right on the heels of that. About between Ry and Taj and Little Feet, what they did to the blues form in terms of reinventing it and shifting it and mixing it with so many, Tex-Mex mixed with Howlin' Wolf. I mean, Little Feet was so innovative, as was Taj. But the first two Taj Mahal albums, like the first two Ry Cooder records, and were just earth-shattering. To this day, they completely hold up, and they are so influential for so many of us. It's so great to be able to talk about them, because a lot of times I know there's many generations since that aren't that familiar, but really there would be no Americana format if it wasn't for artists like Ry and Little Feet and Taj, and then people like Mavis and John Hyatt and Delbert McClinton and John Prine. I mean, nobody knew where to put us. We weren't country, we weren't rock, we weren't blues. And thank God for the Americana format, and always for public radio. I was like the queen of PBS. It's the only place that would play me was I would get these specials on public television. And thank God for Austin City Limits. So I'm sitting here talking to you this many decades later, and you're on the radio as well because of the roots that these guys gave us. And thank God they stuck with it and formed this format that allows us to have a home.
That's absolutely true. I was actually at the conference when they formed the Americana format in New Hampshire. It was actually on a resort where On Golden Pond was filmed.
I've been to that place. I actually visited. My dad was performing his last time in Carousel at 63 years old. He still looked incredible. And my dad and I went to the set to visit my dear friend Jane Fonda, who was filming On Golden Pond with Katharine Hepburn and her dad. So we had this fantastic lunch with Jane and her dad and me and my dad. I'll never forget it. I have not thought of that in years, so thanks for reminding me. Now that the Grammys have become so, important for them to not have classical or blues or jazz on the TV show. It's really just about ratings. Right. And there's so many more subsequent generations of artists that are much more significant in the massive markets than those of us that would be considered more roots-oriented artists. It's been really great as a lifesaver for us to have Americana. A lot of younger people are coming into appreciating classic jazz, traditional blues, traditional bluegrass, and thank God for film soundtracks and TV soundtracks, which are also using underappreciated or unknown people under the radar. And whoever are the people that are charged with finding those gems. I mean, I know, because I'm always looking for great songs to cover on my record, and I'm deep turning over rocks of asking journalists and radio people to see if there's anybody in their area I mean, Tom Brousseau is one of those, if I'm saying his name right, he's what, I mean, there's so many artists that the that aren't known nationally that are so worthy of wider attention. So thank goodness for shows like yourself.
Bonnie, do you know that I was the first person to ever play Tom on the radio?
Is that true?
That's true.
Oh, God. You know what? When I was doing my photo shoot for Slipstream, I used Sam Jones, the great photographer, does so many covers and has his own cable television show as well. As a present at the end of the photo shoot, he brought in Tom to play a few songs for us. I was just in love.
Tom, it was so funny. I can remember it so clear. He had golden hair, and he used to wear this kind of Roy Rogers tan cowboy jacket with fringes. And he came in, and he brought this CD that he'd recorded. It had four songs on it, basically home recording. And I put it on, and just to be nice, because I liked, you know, I thought he was a good young fellow, you know, positive. And I put it on, and the first couple that I dropped the needle on, I immediately thought, this guy has a future. I mean, he doesn't sound like anybody I've ever heard.
Oh, absolutely. He's so absolutely unique. I mean, it reminded me of the first time I heard Lyle Love that I just went, man, this guy's got it. You know, it's hard to be unique in this world, and Tom is really a soulful cat. And I'm looking forward to actually hearing Anne Humphrey, who I don't know. I've just heard her music, and I'm really looking forward to having her on the show with Amy and Emily.
She's really good, actually. She's a very good songwriter. And has been for many years. Bonnie, thank you so much.
Yeah, and you know what, Mike? I really had a great time talking with you.
Singer-songwriter Bonnie Raitt talking with our Mike Olson. Mike hosts Into the Music and the Saturday Evening Blues Cruise for Prairie Public's radio network, and their conversation lasted about a half hour. You can hear it all at prairiepublic.org. Just click on our public news page. Matt Olean and a movie review next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
All those trumpets, all that brass says it's time to talk about movies with Matt Olean, and this week we're going to talk about Wind River.
Yeah, so this is directed by Taylor Sheridan, and he is the screenwriter, Doug, of Hell or High Water and Sicario, so now he's kind of moving into directing. And the film definitely has that Hell or High Water feel to it. It's got that rural law enforcement setting, just like worked so well last year with Hell or High Water, which got it a Best Picture nomination. We'll have to see as the year goes on whether Wind River is a contender for a couple awards or not. It takes place in Wyoming. It was actually shot in Wyoming, so that's nice to hear. A lot of times we find, Doug, because of tax breaks or whatever, these films that are supposed to be shot in and around the Dakotas or Montana, they end up shooting them up in Canada. Mm-hmm. This was shot near Riverton and Lander down there on the Wind River Reservation. I lived in Riverton for 1 year in fourth grade, as a side note. And it's got the feel of a film that's shot where it's supposed to be shot. You get the sense of poverty on the reservation, the lives lost, the lives that are in peril, drug abuse, etc. And the film centers around the murder and disappearance of a Native American girl. We see her in the first scene running through snow, running for her life from something from what we're not sure. And that's the mystery. Jeremy Renner plays a fish and wildlife expert who's good at tracking, and he knows all the back trails. And so when the FBI is brought in with the Indian police, they kind of use him because they need him to find out, you know, how did she die? Where did she run to? Who did she run from? And that's where the mystery starts to come in. Graham Greene from Dances with Wolves fame plays the head of the Indian police. He gives a very nice performance. Renner, this is probably Renner's best performance since Hurt Locker, I think, Doug. The only problem with the film is Elizabeth Olsen, who plays the FBI agent. She kind of plays this green agent who's sent up from Vegas. I never bought her in this role. There's something missing, something requisite that was needed for this part, and it doesn't work for her. She's actually a pretty good actress in the Marvel films and a few other films, but it just doesn't work, and I really think they needed some other actress. It kind of threw off the film for me. The film lags a little bit in the narrative in parts, but overall, I think what it is it's an effective portrait of reservation life, and the law enforcement investigation. It's a short film. It's less than 100 minutes long. Solid film, maybe not as good as Hell or High Water. And that might also be, Doug, because I don't think Sheridan is quite the assured director that David McKenzie was on Hell or High Water. There's a couple spots where I felt the film lagged a little bit, some scenes that didn't quite come off for me. But overall, I liked it.
Okay. Any particular performances besides Jeremy Renner's?
Yeah, Graham Greene is very good as the Indian police agent. All of the parts, Doug, with the Native American parts, are played by Native American actors. And so I think that's great. What we're seeing now, and we've seen this for a while, is the dream of Marlon Brando, who famously refused his Godfather Oscar because of treatment of Native Americans by the film industries. You and I grew up with it, Doug. We'd see Burt Lancaster in Apache, or, you know, Bruce Cabot or Howard Keel playing a Native American in a John Wayne picture with no sensitivity at all that they could have hired a Native American actor. And that changed with a guy named Chief Dan George in Little Big Man. So what we're seeing now is the fruition of his dream, and that we're seeing films cast with Native actors, and they're all very, very fine in their performances.
Well, a sidebar here is that there was this week news of an actor who dropped out of a film because he thought that he
Asian.
It was an Asian sort of role, one of those comic book roles, and he said, no, I shouldn't play this role.
Yeah, so that's good. In the film, by the way, Doug, Renner, his ex-wife is Native American. And so that's a subplot that's very interesting. Is it also chronicles the disappearance and death of his daughter in the film. And so it becomes personal for him to investigate this girl's death and what happened to her. And that's an interesting sidelight about how people deal with grief, how they move on from grief, how they never do move on from grief. And so that's an interesting sidelight. So in the film, it's interesting that Renner's ex-wife is Native American and his children are, you know, half Native American. So a lot of interconnections there with his performance in Wind River. I liked Renner a lot in this part.
Now, will audiences be entertained by the intricacies of the mystery?
Yes. I think audiences in our country, our region, Doug, will like this film. There was a lot of people there when I saw it. It's a film that's now in wide release. I think it's got that kind of, you know, rural backwoods, maybe not backwoods, but it's got that barren landscape. There's a great line in the film where Renner says, all the people have here are snow and silence. Mm-hmm. And that really says, it kind of paints up this life on the reservation, life really where you got to be tough to live in these elements of Wyoming in the middle of nowhere.
Well, this is a movie I want to see.
Yep, pretty good film.
All right. Well, here's a little Oscar trivia question here. What is the only film to win Best Picture without being nominated in any other category?
Wow. No other categories, not director or anything like that?
Correct.
Crazy.
I'll give you a little hint here. Irving Thalberg.
The Great Ziegfeld.
The Grand Hotel.
Grand Hotel, yes.
1931-32.
Right. Okay, that's a great question.
All right. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
This is Dakota Daybook for September 1st. The Oaks Republican newspaper ran an advertisement for Calumet baking powder, touting it as the only high-quality baking powder at a moderate price. But from the 1880s to the 1920s, there was a vicious feud between two different schools of thought in the baking powder business. The established manufacturers utilized cream of tartar, but the young upstarts created the alum phosphate formula. Everyone had an opinion, from commercial bakers to chemists to ordinary housewives. The Calumet Company of Chicago was one of the first manufacturers to embrace the new formula. Calumet touted superior results in the kitchen. The company highlighted the product's double leavening action and promised perfect results. Interestingly enough, the founder of Calumet was William Monroe Wright of Dayton, Ohio, an older cousin of the famous Wright brothers. At one time, he had worked for the Royal Company, a producer of cream of tartar. The Royal Company represented the old guard. Their product was more expensive, But instead of yielding to the new upstart, the company engaged in a relentless campaign against Calumet's new product. The royal company bribed state legislatures to pass anti-alum legislation. Royal also put out news stories citing false health studies that warned of risks of using Calumet's baking powder. Media outlets picked up these stories and presented them as fact. The public was soon convinced that the use of the product could result in hospitalization and even death. One of Royal's advertisements was titled, "Is it Malaria or Is it Alum?" It asserted that Calumet's baking powder was highly injurious and should be prohibited by law. By the turn of the century, however, Calumet was beginning to win the baking powder war. People liked to bargain and weren't put off by Royal's fearful claims, which Calumet countered by making a public offer of $1,000 for anyone able to find any substance injurious to health in Calumet baking powder. But the flap over baking powders continued. In 1913, the North Dakota Food Commissioner took exception to alum added to baking powders, calling the inclusion of egg albumin a fraud that made the product perform better in tests while having no real benefit when it came to cooking. Consequently, the state's food commissioner issued new rules and regulations for baking powder that prohibited albumin. In the end, Calumet survived the baking powder wars, and the product advertised in the Oaks Republican in 1899 can still be found on shelves today, but with some revisions. It doesn't contain albumin, but it's part of a newer dispute over sodium aluminum sulfate. Concern over aluminum has led some competitors to tout themselves as aluminum-free. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Hello, everyone. This is Clay Jenkinson of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, heard every Sunday at 11 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public. Thomas Jefferson was the founder of the University of Virginia at Charlottesville. In fact, he listed it as one of his three primary achievements on his tombstone. As a Jefferson scholar, I find it impossible not to discuss the recent dramatic events in Charlottesville. We've had a flood of emails about this at the Jefferson Hour, asking us to put this in some sort of historical context. I will be talking about it not as the third president, Thomas Jefferson, but as humanities scholar Clay Jenkinson this Sunday on the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Please listen.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
Monday on Main Street, we'll have a special show for Labor Day. We hope you'll take that in, and we hope you have a wonderful Labor Day weekend. And if you're listening Sunday morning, tune in to Main Street Weekend at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.